It is Radio City. John Grayson and Rob Ross hanging out with you for the next, hour or so of conversation and music and whatever else happens to be going on. And Rob, I don't know how things are going in New York, but, you know, we look around the rest of the country. If only there was something to talk about, you know what I mean?
I know. There's just never anything happening. Well, let's start with the obvious. What were the odds that 2 weeks in a row the show would be delayed by a day because of weather?
Yeah, right. Yeah. You had the power outage, and then last night we had storms roll through, and we were kind of keeping our fingers crossed because usually in our little town in southern Illinois, if somebody drives through on Route 3 and spits out the window, it's enough to knock power out to half the town.
Jesus H.
But we were able to make it through okay, and it ended up being a pretty decent night. And we have late breaking news, as a matter of fact, by the way. Just over the last couple hours, we had what they're considering now a terrorist attack in Toronto, Canada, of all places, on Yonge Street, which has seen my shadow more times than I care to count. And we also have news just now breaking, and this is really not much of a surprise to anybody, but When Barbara Bush died just a few days ago, people started wondering about George Herbert Walker Bush and how much longer he was going to hang on without her. He is now in the ICU with sepsis. So the answer is probably not very much longer.
Right. Which is, it's sad. What else are you going to say except it's sad?
Right. But, you know, from his perspective, the man is, I believe, 93 years old, and he's been married to the same woman for 73 of those 93 years. What's he going to do without her? You know, there comes a point where you're 93 years old. What are you fighting for anymore?
Exactly. And, our best to him. What can you say? He was the president of the United States. End of story.
Right. Absolutely. And all of the politics and everything else has been fought over for 25 years ago. Let's leave it back there and just tip our hat to a man. And I mean, who knows? The man may very well get better. He is a tough, tough dude. But don't forget, this is also a man who came very, very close to death during World War II when his plane crashed off the island of Chichijima and was ready to take his own life rather than be captured by one of the most brutal island dictators known to man at that point. He was, he was saved at the last minute by a submarine, but a man who just had so much adversity in the early part of his life and overcame it all and became, as you said, president of the United States.
And let's keep perspective here. For whatever your political leanings may be, the man has spent his life serving this country.
Yep.
Whether you like it or not.
And he's not Donald Trump. So, that said.
Well, let's start then with the most obvious other bad news that came down this weekend. And I don't know if you heard, but Starz Channel has canceled Ash vs. Evil Dead.
No.
So next Sunday will be the final episode, the series finale. I guess they knew because they touted it as the series finale. My guess is probably, amongst other things, it was far too expensive to make because it's filmed in New Zealand.
Right.
That's a hell of a cost to try and get all those actors down there.
Not to mention the fact that it's a special effects intensive show, and those are, by their very nature, expensive to produce. Less so than they were in the past, but still expensive.
The thing is, though, for 3 years, boy, it gave me no end of laughs.
Right.
It's a great series. It's had a great run. And if they're going to go out, at least go out on a high. No pun intended.
Yeah, right. And with Bruce Campbell, I mean, you can't help but go out on a high. So, again, tip of the hat to him as well. And we had a couple of things go on. We mentioned what happened in Toronto, and we'll get to some more conversation about that in just a little bit. But in sports, there was, at a Major League Baseball game early in the weekend, I think it was Friday night, at a Chicago White Sox game, they had a pitcher collapse in the dugout, and of all things, it was an aneurysm that was, to the best of anybody's knowledge, completely undetected, as most are, and it ruptured during the game. He was not on the field, he was in the dugout, but he just collapsed in the dugout and has been unconscious and in intensive care ever since. So all fingers are crossed for him, but what a thing for somebody early in life and in tip-top condition, because you have to be a professional athlete, to just have something go on like that, that reminds us all again of just how fragile life is and how fragile humanity is.
Exactly. The thing is that as of right now, he is progressing well. That's the miracle part of this, because those can be so, it's a very, very, touchy thing when something like this happens. And, Danny Farquhar is progressing well, according to the doctors, after going the surgery on Sunday. On Saturday for the aneurysm. Now, at first reports, it was he was in stable but serious to grave condition. I mean, that's very bleak.
Yep.
This is good news. You know, so you know that if he is indeed progressing, then there's hope.
Right, and that's all we can do at this point is hope for him and for the team and for family members and everything else that he is able to cling on to life and have some sort of, I think, you know, again, professional sports be damned at this point. It's can the man be who he was before?
All that really matters is that he can regain his health in full. That's,
right.
That's it.
Right.
That's long and short of it.
Yeah, exactly. So hoping for a better outcome than was expected, at least in those first couple of hours, because as you said, I mean, not only was his condition listed as grave, but the you could tell on their faces. I mean, nobody on the team who was commenting on this at all expected any kind of a decent outcome to this. So hoping for the best. And I want to get to Toronto because what happened today left 9 people dead, 16 people injured. And there was an incident that took place in Nashville, Tennessee, again, just a couple of days ago that we will get to because there's a lot to say about that. I thought it was interesting after, and Yonge Street, just to kind of set the scene a little bit, is a place that, I mean, back during the 80s, this was the place we used to go if we went to Toronto to party. And I don't mean, you know, get drunk or whatever, but it was just, it was such a loose and groovy atmosphere. I posted a little bit on Facebook about this today. Yonge Street was like if you took the grooviest part of any college town and expanded it and dropped it right in the middle of a city of 8 million people. Everything was cool. You know, there were shops where, you know, you could buy a tire for drag shows right next to shops where they were selling condoms, right next to shops where, you know, there were head shops and all kinds of stuff and all kinds of crazy, weird restaurants from all parts of the world, some parts you had never even heard of. And everybody was having a good time. Unlike a lot of those kind of groovier sections of town, it wasn't seedy. You know, Yonge Street was, it was nice and it was safe. And it was still totally cool. The northern part of Yonge Street where this attack took place today, where a guy drove through a crowd in a van, killing 9 people and injuring 16, as we said, is it has turned now into kind of the upper Asian section of the city. There's a bunch of high-rise apartment buildings there now, and what used to be these crazy head shops are now like karaoke bars and electronics stores, which is, again, a groove of its own. That's a little bit different than it was in the old days, but it still was a very alive and buzzy section of town, which I'm sure is what made it a target for this guy, whatever his motives were, to try and kill people, because there's always a bunch of people walking the streets. I would hate to see that change about Yonge Street.
Well, first thing is that Toronto is the hometown of a very, very close, dear friend of mine. So, you know, my immediate thought when I heard Toronto was about her.
Right. I hope she's okay. Sure.
She's fine. You know, she lives here in New York with her family, but, you know, she's always in Toronto and her family is there. Having said that, you know, when you hear about something like this and that it was a van that plowed into multiple pedestrians,
yep,
you can't help already but think this was an intentional terrorist attack. Now, I'm going to read this little snippet to you from CNN. A U.S. official has confirmed to CNN, and sources tell CNN partner CTV that the suspect is Alek Manassian. That's spelled A-L-E-K. He was previously known to Toronto authorities, according to a U.S. law enforcement official briefed on the matter.
Which, again, so, echoes some of what we heard about what happened in Nashville. They knew this guy was a problem. What kind of problem he was doesn't matter, but they knew he was a problem.
And his father gave him back the gun that had been already confiscated previously by authorities.
Right.
So someone else is very culpable in this. And by the way, before we go on to that story, he was in fact captured today.
Yes. Right. And that was the late update on the Nashville story as well, is that the young man who was responsible for that shooting he was captured, and it was in the same set of woods where he had been seen. The last credible sighting of him took place a day or two ago, and he apparently has been out there wandering around the woods for the last couple of days. But they got him, and they said he surrendered effectively without incident. They said he did what he was told, and they put the cuffs on him and took him off to the Huskow.
Well, I guess if there's any kind of silver lining, yesterday the Nashville Predators took out the Colorado Avalanche.
Yes. Four games to two, yeah.
They took care of that in short order. And it was a very, very good game. Very hard-fought game, but, boy, Nashville were relentless.
Right. Yeah, and that's the thing. The Predators are a tough, tough young team, and I expect big things from them. We've got a lot to talk about when it gets to hockey as well, but just to sort of wrap up the Toronto story, the one thing that I thought they did very well is in the first press conference that they gave, which was, I believe it was the chief of police in Toronto and another city official. It may very well have been the mayor, but they did not take any questions. They said, look, this is very early. This just happened. We don't know very much. Here's what we do know. We're not taking any questions. When we have more to say, we'll be glad to talk more to the reporters. But it was just an informational thing, and it was a pretty open one as well.
Well, I definitely fear the notion that we've not heard the last of these kinds of incidents.
Right.
They're starting to ramp up, I feel, more and more.
Well, the last one was right down the street from you. I mean, it was in New York, about a year ago, right?
Oh, the one in Lower Manhattan?
Yep.
Was that the last one, or was there one overseas?
There may have been. I know there were a couple in France, and one of them may have been in between. But still, yeah, you're right. It's happened in France. It's happened in London. There was, right. So on and on we go. And unfortunately, it's the same modus because, and in this case, Ryder Truck once again takes it on the chin as if it wasn't bad enough. Tim McVeigh used one of their trucks to blow up the Murrah building. It looks like it was one of their trucks that was used in this incident in Toronto as well.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Now, getting into what happened in Nashville, again, odd connection here that Waffle House where the shooting took place, it's about a 5-minute drive from my last house in Nashville that we left in 1999. I'm sorry, early 2000 to move here. And I know that area very, very well. The Starwood Amphitheater, which is a legendary outdoor concert venue in Nashville, is a stone's throw from that Waffle House. In fact, I think that was during the summer months, probably a good portion of their business came from people either going to or leaving Starwood. But, to have something like that go on in an area that, you know, again, is a very well-traveled and alive and buzzy kind of area, full of young people, noteworthy in the fact that the people who died were all between the ages of 21 and 25, gives you a little bit of insight into what kind of an area we're talking about. And it's just, you know, nobody's safe. And on some level, we know that, but whenever it's brought home again, it just never sits well.
You can't enjoy a quiet Sunday breakfast after church or whatever. And
right.
But let's say, even though he doesn't want to be referred to it, we've got to give a tip of the hat to that young man, that incredible young man who fought the gunman.
Yeah, James Shaw Jr. And this guy,
that kid, he have a long life and nothing but good things for him.
Yeah, and the thing that I like the most about what he did is that, I mean, not only outside of wrestling the gunman and getting the gun away from him and throwing it across the room, suffering burns to his hands and arms along the way, by the way, because the gun was still hot from firing. So not only did he do that, but he said, as we've heard people say before, you know, I don't like the hero moniker. I don't think of myself as a hero. But in the past, when we hear people say that, it's normally because they'll say, I just did what anybody would do. And that's the kind of modesty that goes along with somebody doing something extraordinary. It's hard to admit that you did something extraordinary. But in this case, he didn't do that. He didn't take that road. He said, I don't consider myself a hero because, even though he didn't put it in these terms, what he said was effectively, I was trying to save my own ass. And he said, you know, I consider it a selfish thing because I was saving my own life. It's not heroic. But you know what? I'm with you. I find it hard. I don't care what the motivations were. And I like it even better that he said, I don't consider myself a hero because I was acting selfishly. what kind of, when was the last time you heard that kind of raw honesty out of anybody?
Raw honesty aside, he did it.
You're right.
You know, however you want to phrase it, that's fine, but he did it. You know, he did what a lot of people, I hate to say it, just could not do,
right,
or wouldn't do, you know, because you don't know if, God forbid, you're in that situation, how do you respond? You know, are you paralyzed with fear? Are you going to take the approach that I don't care what happens to me, but I don't want this person killing others?
Right.
You know, he put himself in harm's way. And for that, there's just nothing else to do but thank him.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that mentality of, if I'm going to go out, I'm going to go out fighting. There's a lot to be said for that. And again, if you're trying to save your own skin or everybody else around you, the result is the same. He's a hero.
Yeah. And God bless him.
Yeah.
And a quick recovery and just nothing but good things.
Now, on to the shooter. Because as you mentioned before, his guns were taken away from him when he tried to breach the White House grounds, telling people, and I've said this so many times before, if you want to know if somebody is an asshole, ask him if he's ever used the term sovereign citizen to describe himself. If he says yes, he's an asshole. And guess what? When this kid showed up at the White House trying to breach the grounds, he told the guards he was a sovereign citizen and was there to see the president. So, obviously a nut bar, so they took all of his guns away and gave them to his father for safekeeping. And what happened, Rob?
His father gave him back the guns.
What the fuck?
Well, very simply put, someone else is going to jail. And I don't care what lawyer it is on what planet, that father has to go serve time as an accomplice to murder.
Yep.
It's that simple.
Yeah, no question about it.
Terrorism, because that's what that is. And you know, this is the one thing I'm kind of tired about. These kinds of acts in the United States by citizens against other citizens. You know, not to be funny, but this aggression will not stand.
Right.
It won't. It can't. It must not. It should not. The law is the law, you know? And in this case, the father aided and abetted, complicit,
right,
totally complicit.
Right. Somebody who was violently crazy, and he gave him guns. I mean, and that's the other thing. Going all the way back to Columbine with the rich, snotty, isolated parents that were involved in that, Harris and Klebold's parents, and they're all going, oh, we didn't know. If you didn't know, you are just as complicit because you're a lousy parent and had no idea this kind of thing was
right.
going on. But this guy took it a step farther than that.
That's what he seemed to say, you know, oh, I didn't know, you know. On the flip side of that, and I don't mean to go off on a tangent, but in New York now, de Blasio wants to cut down on having, you know, teens sent to prison for crimes.
What's he want to do? Really? Put them up at his place?
Are you kidding? We're talking about now. I mean, it's just, we've reached this apex of sheer lunacy combined with stupidity.
Yeah.
Blatant, negligent stupidity. But this kid and his father, well, look, I've never minced my words. I'm a big believer of the death penalty. And I really hate the fact that we always seem to drag things out. And someone like this, why would you even put him on death row? Take him out. And well, in my way of thinking, in my universe, you don't waste time. You don't give him a, you know, you put him down humanely with a lethal injection. No, you take him out with a bullet to the back of the head, or you put him in an electric chair. You don't gas him. None of that. No, you make them suffer. The way someone, it's an eye for an eye. And if people don't like that, I'm sorry, but the older I get, that's all it is. It's an eye for an eye.
Yeah.
And simple.
Well, and like I said, I mean, I understand somebody who is violently insane. I mean, I don't understand them. I guess that's by definition, I don't understand them.
But you try to understand the motivation and, you know, what are the threads that tie it all together?
Right.
You try to understand.
Right.
As any rational human being will do.
Yeah. And I get that there are people who are so far gone that you can't get inside their head. You look at the shooter in Charleston, South Carolina, the guy who shot up the church, the young punk, and this he was a young racist horrifying person who was raised by young or by older racist, horrifying parents.
Right. The Roof family are all garbage.
Right. Right. And his little sister is proving that out by some of the things that she's done since then. So, you know, that's a different situation. That's somebody making, actively making a choice. And, you know, with this, it seems much more like somebody who was so far gone that the voices in the head took over or whatever. And who knows? But if you're, if you're a parent and you see those kinds of signs, I mean, when the White House takes your kids' guns away.
By the way, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I have a question. Which president was this that he was, quote, trying to
Trump.
See?
I don't think it was that long ago. I think it was within the last year. I'll have to check that. I could be wrong on that, but I'll see if I can get some confirmation on that. I think it was within the last year or so.
Because certainly his victims were of a particular group. Unless he just went in there and because he saw a crowd, he just started shooting. I don't know.
But that's true. Yeah, just about everybody in there was black. There was one Hispanic who was killed.
Then what? The question is, was this, quote, racially motivated, or was this just the fact that he saw a crowded Waffle House and said, now.
Right. Yeah. And who knows? Because, again, trying to rationalize an irrational act is going to get you nowhere.
Right.
So, yeah, in the meantime, I'm sure that the investigators right now are trying to delve into that brain and find out exactly what was going on in there. But you're right. If the father isn't charged with a serious raft of felonies over this, then there's something wrong with the system.
Well,
that's yeah, I know.
In of itself, yeah, that's you're opening up the can of worms right there.
Well, here's an interesting thing, though. Just a little quick sidebar on this, because I did hear one tidbit over the weekend, and keeping track of good old WSMV down in Nashville, and they said that there's nothing in Tennessee law that would allow for prosecuting the father over this. However, it was the federal authorities who told him not to give the guns back, and he signed a paper with them swearing that he wasn't going to give the guns back right before he turned around and gave the guns back. That's the thing. Tennessee charges I don't care about. The feds are going to come after his ass.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Right.
Then we'll never see him again.
Exactly.
Now, I want to go back to something that we were talking about at the opening of the show, and we were talking about Barbara Bush.
Yeah.
And let's talk about – you've heard this story as well as I have, and it didn't get that much traction. In the immediate aftermath of Barbara Bush's death, a, quote, tenured professor called her an amazing racist and then taunts her critics and saying, I will never be fired. You know – there is something that really needs to be done with this. There's freedom of speech, and then there's completely going off onto a tangent that you should not be going towards. And this is some teacher at
something University of California at Fresno or someplace like that. Yeah.
And she happens to be Iranian. Make of that what you will. Make of that what you will.
Well, and the thing is, it's not a free speech issue. It has absolutely nothing to do with First Amendment because she's not being threatened with any kind of legal reprisals. But the First Amendment does not protect your job. If you shoot your mouth off and embarrass your employer, they can fire you. That's period, end of story. That is not a free speech issue in any way.
And I hope she gets fired.
Yeah. Well,
it's apparently, known for being a spiteful loudmouth with this kind of flaunting of whatever you want to call it.
Right. Yeah. Well, and the way I look at that is that the real crime is not insulting Barbara Bush. She wouldn't be the first. Okay. Barbara Bush could take it. You know, that was the one thing about her is that she had suffered criticism over the course of her life and she never whined about it. But when you do that to somebody, and she wasn't the only one, because Roger Stone did effectively the same thing, stupid prick.
Well, how long have I been saying I would like to see him tied to the back of a of a pickup truck and dragged down a gravel road for about 10 miles?
Yeah, so...
And if there's any whimpering, then you take out the baseball bats.
But the thing is, when you take the occasion, there's that natural disinclination to speak ill of the dead. Okay, and I get that. And people get really touchy about it when you go after somebody right after they die. But in my mind, it's not even so much that she, this professor, or Roger Stone for that matter, spoke ill of the dead. It's the fact that they waited until she was gone before they torpedoed her. That's cowardice. You know, because if they had said something like that to Barbara Bush's face while she was alive, she would have responded. And she would have done so probably in a very genteel fashion. But no, they waited until she was dead and couldn't respond. That's yellow.
Well, these are obviously children with problems. But let's see how long this this bloviated professor lasts in Fresno.
Yeah, I hope not much longer. By the way, and just to put the wraps on the angry section of the show.
I mean, the whole thing is, you know, folks, when listening, I'm sure you know we're usually very lighthearted about things. But let's face it, this week has fraught with just madness.
Right.
And you know, we need to talk about it. We just need to get it out. And we're going to put our humorous spin on it, sure. But what we're talking about right now just isn't funny. It's just, it's from the downright tragic and infuriating, like, you know, premeditated murders at a Waffle House or driving a van into pedestrians in Toronto to some, you know, pardon my language, piece of shit who calls herself a professor and an educator, speaking ill of the newly deceased former first lady. You know, it gets on your nerves after a while. We're all human beings. That's why we do this show. That's why we provide an outlet for you to be angry with, you know, and like, wait a minute, here's somebody else who feels the way we do, you know?
And as I was saying, just to put the wraps on this section of the show, I did check, and Ryan King did indeed try to breach the White House grounds this past July. So Donald Trump was in office when he tried to do that. And that's interesting in that it takes a while for paperwork to get done. So that was July of 2017. So that's how many months ago now? Nine months ago. And that's all the time it took for Daddy to give the guns back.
Oh, I'm sure he gave them back much sooner.
Oh, yeah, probably within a week. But come on, even more, even worse now, because he couldn't say, well, you know, it had been a couple of years. The kid hadn't shot his mouth off again. You know, he didn't do anything crazy. I thought he was all better. 9 months after he tries to get into the White House? No.
Do we know anything about the father's background?
Not much, other than that he's from right up the road from here. He's a Southern Illinois guy.
Okay. Well, so much for the crazies being out in full force this last week.
Yeah. So let's get on to the fun stuff. I had a conversation this week on the radio show that we were talking about a little bit before the broadcast, with Gary Brooker from Procol Harum. This is the guy that came up with that famous organ riff for Whiter Shade of Pale and a whole bunch of other great music as well. And it was on the occasion that they released an 8-disc set of just about everything that they hadn't released yet. Although the name of the CD set has the words "more to come" as part of the title. So apparently there is still more out there, but it shows that they did, there's a 73 show that they did with the LA Philharmonic that's on this set. There's a whole bunch of old TV shows and things like that that are part of this thing. The conversation with Brooker was great because he's a funny dude. And you never know what to expect. You go into an interview like that. We've talked about this before. And sometimes you get guys who give you one word answers. And sometimes you get guys who are storytellers and you can't get them to shut up. And then there's guys who are just having a good time being who they are. And those are the ones I really like.
You know, what's great though, is the fact that it's a lot of these older, and I mean older guard people, not the people who came from the punk era or new wave era, but the genuinely older guard. But I think you and I have talked about this before on the show, and it's the fact that especially now, it's not like they're going out to, you know, hype a new album per se, and they're going to go out on tour. They're just happy that somebody wants to hear from them, that they're still thought of and still, you know, respected and wanted, and that makes them feel good, so they're going to present well.
Right.
I appreciate that, because they appreciate being appreciated.
Yeah, and there's something to be said for the life of an older rock star versus, you know, the life of an older accountant, because I'm pretty sure that the rock stars probably live in nicer houses. So, gives them a chance.
Now, when you get Steve Winwood on the show, I'm sure you won't tell me, just like you didn't tell me that you had
with Nesmith.
And you still haven't sent me the file.
I know, it's coming.
But, you know, people like, you know, like Winwood, or who's another one that's just really, really gregarious and you know, always willing to sit down and have a conversation. Well, you know what? Townsend is still like that.
Yeah.
Townsend will sit down and talk your ear off.
Right. And how great is that?
It's Pete Townsend, for God's sake.
Yeah, right. Nothing wrong with that dude. So let's talk a little new music, because there is some to go over this week. You have a review on Popdos of an album called Bon Voyage from a singer by the name of Nina June. This is, I think, a little more in the electronica realm than a lot of what we talk about, but it's also got that voice. Wow.
Right.
Who is she?
You are quite correct. It is more in that electronic, I wouldn't say dance in the heavy-duty beats sense.
Yeah.
It's more of an ethereal thing, although there are indeed beats in this. She's from Amsterdam, actually. And while going through, the story goes, while going through France and Spain on some kind of pilgrimage, she wound up in London and started recording this album.
Huh, okay.
Now, the thing about the record, and you brought up a really good point that this is not in the usual canon. I even said getting out of my usual wheelhouse, you know, in my comfort zone, is a healthy thing. So every now and then I'll go completely into a different realm.
Yeah.
And, you know, the truth is I usually don't enjoy this kind of music per se, because dance music doesn't lend itself well to just sitting at home and listening to it. The reason you're going to listen to something that's got beats is because you're dancing. You know, you're out on the floor. I'm not going to pop on any heavy-duty dance stuff at home and you know, put on the headphones and try and chill out to it. No pun intended.
Yeah.
But here's a couple of main things about it. One, she's got a really beautiful voice. Struck by a landslide. It's a very warm voice. It's a very, she doesn't seem to, she's another one that's, she's a natural singer. You know, she knows how to control the manner, how she delivers a verse. And she's very good and very adept and very smooth in going from loud to a bit more intensity and bringing it back down again. There's a lot of melody in these songs, but there's also ambience, and it works. It works well. It's not an uncomfortable mixture of styles going into it. It's a very emotionally rich painting that she offers.
Yeah.
That's how I look at this. And one of the neat factors is a couple of the songs definitely go back to that kind of 80s synth pop sound that you and I like and get, you know, get a chuckle or a warm bit of nostalgia out of.
Yeah, well, and you just walked right through the door of where I wanted to go with this, because the first name that popped into my head while I was listening to her, and it's, I'm sure it's got something to do with the fact that she doesn't look completely unlike her, but it's also got a lot more to do with the voice itself, is Amy Mann. From the Till Tuesday era, and that's right again in that synth pop vein that you were talking about. And it, I mean, they could have been sisters. So that is, when it comes to female vocalists, and again, we'll return to this during the In Our Head segment, that's something that grabs my ear better than most do, because there is that kind of control. There's an intensity, but there's a control to it as well. And I love the way that this one comes off. I'm going to have to let this one sit with me a little bit more and listen through it a couple of more times, but I like what I hear at the very outset.
Which is always a good, that's always a good sign that, you know, you want to let it stay with you for a while and get a greater feel and absorb it more, you know?
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's the kind of, that's how you can appreciate someone. And also, you know, it's a case of you want to know what they're going to do next.
Definitely.
Because I think for her sense of delivery, I think she could stand to go with a bit more boisterous material. I'm not saying hard beats. I'm saying something a little poppier. You know?
Yep. Unleash it some. Sure. So definitely a good first effort and one you need to check out. Check out the review as well. There's a music link there for you on the page of Bon Voyage from Nina June. And the other musical entry for this week is a revisit. It's a side project of the Feelies. And you and I both have a great affinity for what the Feelies did as a group. But how did Young Woo come about?
That was them basically putting their second percussionist, Dave Weckerman, out in front as lead singer and main songwriter, plus bringing in a couple of the members of Speed the Plow.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a very quick background. When the Feelies were on hiatus, as they had been for quite a while after Crazy Rhythms, they all worked together in one permutation or another, the Tripes, which I would like to see their one record re-released and accessible to everybody, because I had it and it's long gone. This is all the stuff that's very close to my heart, you know, the whole Coyote Records catalog. Young Woo was another one. And this was, like I said, with Dave Weckerman out in front as lead singer and main songwriter, and basically backed up by everybody who was on the Good Earth album, which, of course, is still the Feelies lineup to this day. That's now 32 years later,
mm-hmm.
you know? Because this was done in 1987 and The Good Earth was 1986. It's very, very – it's got a little bit, but not too much of the Feelies style. This is more of that – and granted, I'll mention a band that came along a little later, but it's still in that same vein. And I wouldn't be surprised if they pulled stuff from Young Woo, but it's got that kind of R.E.M. – Miracle Legion, Connells kind of feel to it, you know? Strummed electric guitars that are really buoyant and crisp, you know, quirky keyboards, dry, almost, dare I say, ironic vocals.
Yes, right. And that's what really stands out on this, is that it's as though you took somebody from that latter stage of the early punk era from 1978 or 79 and dropped that style of vocal on top of late 80s pop. And it works great. It has a real signature sound to it. I love it.
Right. And you know, they you could tell that this was a labor of fun. What starts to describe what he saw on Tuesday night? He knows just what as much as I love the Feelies, and we know that I do, I wouldn't consider them a band that's focused on fun. You know, they're intense, you
yeah.
know, they're an intense band. Their songs have always been a little herky-jerky, which is the phrase I think that's almost always used, but you can't help it because that's how it is. They're twitchy songs, you know. This is not that. This is pop.
Right.
Now, this is good college radio era pop.
The other cool thing about it, again, for its era, that kind of makes it stand out a little bit, you mentioned the strummed electric guitars. There's also plenty of acoustics in there as well to round out the sound.
Yeah, so they're completely fleshed out. And what I love about this repackage, because this is the first time it's available on CD, it has been re-released, and I'm going to get to this now because this is the perfect transition. It was re-released on Bar None, which is, of course, the label of Hoboken, with the Coyote Records imprint on it as well, which really brings it all home. It's the first time it's on CD, and it was specifically re-released for Record Store Day, which was Saturday.
Yep.
Which seemed – this to me was a Record Store Day that too many people didn't really bitch about. People seemed to have fun. They all went out. They shopped. And I, of course, got my one major score that I needed to get, even though I didn't physically go to the store, because as we all know, I'm too smart for that. I'm just going to sit here and go to eBay as quickly as possible.
Right.
So I, of course, nailed the Chris Bell single, I Am the Cosmos, You and Your Sister, in the gatefold package with the liner notes by Chris Stamey, reissued on his Car Records label on the 40th anniversary of this release, which I, of course, have the original pressing because I'm like that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this was Record Store Day on Saturday, and people seem to have a lot of fun. And can I complain about that? No, no, no. Because, as we all know, the last couple of years, Record Store Day justifiably has taken a lot of lumps. Deservedly so. Period. This time, not so much.
Right. Well, so, you mentioned your one big score. I've got mine because I've got some sources in the record store industry, and thank you to them for this because I don't have it in my hands yet, but the Led Zeppelin release, the 7-inch from Zepp, I still have not heard. I've not read any reviews of it. I don't want to because the first time that I hear it, I want it to wash over me like those albums did when I brought them home from the record store the first time. So I don't know what it is, but it's the only Zepp release that came out on Record Store Day, and it's on its way to me. The other cool thing was a Birds album, and it came from the same record shop, by the way. This one was a college radio appearance that they had done.
Like the late period Birds, right? 72-ish?
73, right. And it was just, you know, it was a lot of the great stuff that Parsons and White were involved in. So you have the connection back to Kim Fowley, who collaborated on a lot of lyrics. So there's songs on there. Citizen Kane is part of it, which is one of my favorite Birds songs ever. And there's, you know, it's not so much the standard issue Birds Dylan covers, you know. That stuff's great. I love it. But this is a little bit more interesting than that. And it shows you what those guys were really capable of on their own.
Especially apparently that late period Birds, they were apparently just a shit hot live band.
Yep. Right.
Which is funny because that was probably around the time that David Geffen had pulled the original Birds back together for that one reunion album that came out and went nowhere.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. Yeah. But you got to remember, I mean, not only were these guys great technicians, great musicians, and as you said, a shit hot live act, they were also inventors. I mean, Parsons and White, their name is still on the B string bender. They
oh, really?
They did that. You know, that was their thing. They cut open a Fender Telecaster and said, you know, there's got to be a way to make this sound a lot more like a slide guitar without using a slide. And they did it. So, you know, pretty cool.
I thought it was just only Clarence White who got the credit for the bendy string.
Well, he actually did the mechanical work on it.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a neat story. And it's one of those things that even Roger McGuinn later on started getting involved in a bunch of mechanical stuff and invented his own refrigerator of all things. But yeah, it was because he was watching what those guys were doing and went, wow, you really can build your own stuff.
Well, there you go. I mean, they were a greatly inventive band. They were one of the first to use electronics and, you know, if you will, samples.
Right.
In some of their earlier tracks. If you go back to the 5D album, you know, with something like, what was it? 242 Foxtrot, the Learjet song,
mm-hmm.
You know, or CTA 102 with the use of what sounds like Martian voices.
Yeah,
you know. Listen, I love the Birds, so I'm very biased, no matter what.
Yeah, well,
so good for you. Congratulations on getting a good score.
Thanks. Yeah.
Me, what's the Zeppelin tracks on the single?
I don't know. Yeah, like I said, I've not read a single word about it.
It's just a Led Zeppelin single, and that's that.
Exactly. So I know it's on its way, and next time we talk, I will have it in my hands. I will have listened to it by then, and I'll be able to give you a full review of what's on it.
Well, I can tell you right now that even though it's not in my hands yet, I can tell you exactly what's on this single. Every night I tell myself, I am the cosmos. I am the wind. But that don't get you back again.
Nice. Excellent. Oh, and by the way, there's a show, and I wish I could remember the name of it. It's one of the ones that my lovely bride watches each and every week without fail. And it's a, you know, it's a fine little piece of television. We'll get into talking about The Walking Dead in just a couple as well. But it's one of those time travel shows where they've got some kind of device and they jump into this thing and, you know, there's a big chase over time and there's the bad guys who are always out to get them. And this week's episode featured a subplot about the bad guys trying to stop Robert Johnson from recording his record. And it was pretty damn entertaining, actually. And I'll tell you what, they got a guy who looks a lot like Robert Johnson. I was impressed.
All right.
So it's good to know that somebody notices and somebody still remembers something past last week.
I don't.
Yeah, me either, which is part of the problem.
That's the beauty of age.
Yeah. Oh, I hear you, man. And we've got a few more things to go over before we get to it. But yeah, like I said, The Walking Dead came to its season finale this week as well. What did we miss?
Well, I'll tell you what. It was definitely far more satisfying than the last few episodes. You know, they've taken this storyline of, you know, and this is not a spoiler thing, but, you know, the war between the Saviors and Hilltop and blah, 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 and Rick and Negan and all that. And, you know, Rick didn't kill Negan. He just cut his throat, you know.
Uh-huh.
And Eugene was the quiet hero as he booby-trapped. This was, I think, the best thing about the episode. If you haven't seen it yet, skip everything and just watch this. He booby-trapped the Savior's guns. He was the bullet maker since he's the science guy.
Uh-huh.
And he was, you know, elevated to Negan's number two. He booby-trapped the guns and the bullets so that when they surrounded the folks from Hilltop and were going to execute them, they shot themselves. It was a magnificent moment. It really was. Negan actually shoots himself in the hand accidentally. I mean, it was just a thing of beauty. Didn't see it coming. It was a very satisfying ending for the season. The thing is, I think we're reaching that point of, okay, how much further can you carry this on?
Right.
You know, every week it's the same thing. Yeah. Zombies are there, somebody dies, somebody that you really love on the show dies, blah, blah, blah.
Right, and we're back to the same old thing, and we'll see you again next week for more of the same.
Right.
And that's the trick, is knowing when to get out, knowing when it's time, right, that it's played out and you've done all you can do.
And here's the thing about, you know, Ash versus Evil Dead. You know, they pretty much have spent it all now. You know, they really have. I mean, what more can you do? I mean, you don't want to run something good into the ground and make people roll their eyes and go, ugh.
Right.
When is this going to be over with? You know, Homeland has been uneven. You know, they're in a storyline now with Russia, for God's sakes.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to unseat the president, which they have done. This show is getting to be too much because now it's just taking from the headlines, really. And by the way, I noticed last night, and shows how much I've disconnected from it, that what used to be wonderful show The Circus on Showtime, the political show,
uh-huh,
that's been hosted by John Heilman, Mark Halperin, and Mark McKinney. Halperin's not there, so I could not care less.
Wow. Okay.
I will not watch it. Look. He's already served his penance. Let him get his job back, at least on that show, because it doesn't work without him.
Yeah.
Plucking in Alex Wagner is not the answer. I'm sorry. She's just not – she just doesn't work on it. It's that simple. Plus, we're not in the middle of an election cycle anymore. That was the whole point of it. It was about the elections.
Right.
You know? We don't need to know what's going on in Trump land. We know what's going on in Trump land.
Yeah, right. It's all gone crazy, and I'm glad that we've spent as little time talking about it in this episode as we have.
Right. I'll say it very quickly. Sean Hannity is one of Cohen's clients. Ooh!
Yeah, right. What a surprise.
And that's that. So now let's talk about something important. We talked about the passing of Barbara Bush, which was very sad. We also lost a couple of other people. None greater, certainly, to you and I than the living legend, Bruno Sammartino.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, what do you say? A guy who was there. I mean, he was Worldwide Wrestling Federation first, right?
Actually, he was an independent before McMahon Sr. finally got him to sign a deal. He didn't come in full to the WWWF until around 72, 73.
Yeah. And it, you know, it was one of the coolest things that I saw this week, and I actually sent it to you as soon as I saw it, was that picture of the marquee at Madison, yes, Square Garden. And it was just that iconic photo of Bruno standing there, you know, and it just said MSG Remembers. And I thought, what a cool thing. Whoever classed up the joint by putting that picture up, thumbs up to you, man. That was great.
It was great. And I'm very appreciative of it. And, you know, that once again signifies that our youth is in fact long over and our heroes are now leaving us.
Yeah.
As time and tide passes. You know, having said that, you know, we also, this is not a death. We're going to get to more. Well, let me put it this way. For those who've listened over the years to NPR, Carl Castle was always a staple of NPR. His was the voice that everyone knew mm-hmm. of NPR. And he passed away last week.
Wow.
At the beginning of the week. But nobody's really talked about or mentioned, not a passing, but a rite of passage that Don Imus signed off for the last time on March 29th after 50 years. Imus in the morning is no more. Imus is now silent. He took himself off the air, A, because he's got emphysema and is down to one lung. Mm. Two, he wants to spend what time he has left with his family on the ranch. And three, he's done it for 50 years.
Right. Yeah, and what's he got left to prove?
Right. He's Don Imus. He was there first. He did it before everybody else. He did it before Stern, and he went to war with Stern because Stern loves to provoke. Interestingly enough, though, he was deified by Opie and Anthony.
Yeah.
They loved him. They supported him through that episode with the Rutgers basketball team. And he managed to come back. And he came back very strong. And I thought it was very touching and very fitting to listen to the last 5 minutes of his show. And the last words he said on the air were, and you could hear him weeping. There's no question about it. He was completely emotional, which really showed his human side, which you often didn't really get. You got the angry human side, but his genuineness. And I think the last words were, I did this. You did this. We did this. Mm-hmm. You're goddamn right we did this. And then you hear the sound of him knocking the microphone away, and that's it. And it was a very powerful moment. But yeah. After all these years, Don Imus is no longer a staple of morning radio.
Yeah.
I cannot tell you how long I spent years listening to him. You know, first on 66 WNBC. and this is Imus in the morning.
Yeah.
And then when he got fired and the replacement show was Brink and Belzer. Yes, you heard correctly.
Wow.
They were hysterical. They were brilliant. And then they fired them, and they brought back Imus, who then became twice as funny because he had characters like Billy Saul Hargis and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, and he still played great music on AM radio in the morning. Plus, he had his regular, you know, cronies with him, Charles McCord, Bernard McGurk, and, of course, Larry Kenny, who introduced me to the One Dick's Eye View. You know, it was brilliant, you know. But it was also a smart show, especially as you got into the 90s. I mean, Bill Clinton was on the air, you know, with Imus regularly. Because right. As Clinton has often said, if it wasn't for Imus, I may not have become president. So there you go. That's quite a hell of an acknowledgement that one radio personality can help elect a president.
Yeah, and he's a guy who always got it. I mean, he understood the medium better than anybody. And everybody makes mistakes. Everybody screws up. But he got it. He understood that more than anyone else, and he taught the rest of us this, that radio is a singular medium. It is a conversation between two people. And it may only be a one-sided conversation. Only one of them may be talking, but it's still one person talking to one other person, and that's it. And if you can master that the way Don Imus did, you can go far in this business.
The beauty of what we do, which is really a carry-on from all of that, is the fact that we're having a conversation that we're sharing with other people.
Right.
And that's what makes something like this powerful and special, because you've got shows like, well, not anymore, but you had Opie and Anthony, who had their own thing, their own rhythm, their own style, but then they brought other people in, and it made it a community,
right?
You know, and that was really special and groundbreaking in and of itself, because it's one thing if you've got a cast of characters like Stern does, right? The way Opie and Anthony did it, it was an all-embracing, no-holds-barred thing. But they also showcased the talent that was there. Not, and it was a genuine sense of community because everyone was friends.
Yeah, right.
You know, and that's why we do this, because we are friends and we hate everybody else.
That's right. Everyone else be damned. And one last thing before we get to In Our Heads and back to the music for just a second, because we had a couple of things happen over the last little while. The whole Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductions happened. The induction ceremony happened, I should say. And true to form, or true to what he said he was going to do, Mark Knopfler did not go. And Dire Straits was inducted without him, which is a little weird. But, you know, the rest of it went off, I guess, fine. And I'm looking forward to seeing the broadcast, but I don't expect a whole lot out of it. The other thing that's gone on is that while the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is inducting all of its people, there's more and more conversation about Coachella and all of the other, what had been rock festivals, moving farther and farther away from the genre. And you and I are both very zen about this, but there's a group of people who are in our age group who are just losing their minds over this because they see their youth finally passing away.
Well, the thing is, with the Coachella incident, if you will, it's the fact that Beyonce, of all people,
right,
performed with this thing. Now, I don't care one whit about Beyonce, period. She's never on my radar. Coachella is just another money making, you know, concert / festival. Just the way that the so-called, you know, alternative nation got into Lollapalooza, man. Well, first of all, they were moneymakers.
Right.
You know, let's not kid ourselves with some kind of thwarted altruism. And as the years went by, they had less of the rock acts or the less alternative rock acts or less of the freak show, and they had more standard rock acts. But they're charging more and more. You know, $10 for a bottle of water is not acceptable.
Right.
So don't come to me, you know, wringing your hands about, oh, rock is dead, Coachella is helping to kill it by putting on Beyonce. Who cares? If you're stupid enough to pay for this thing, well then, you know what? Go take a bunch of shrooms and go to Burning Man in your bare feet. Leave me alone. I don't care.
Yeah. Well, and you and I both know enough people who are in the sort of road dog rock bands who have been carrying the torch for the last 20 years out there hitting it hard every night, sometimes in bars playing to 15 people. And you want to know what? It's not Coachella that's killing rock and roll. It's the people who don't go to those concerts. It's the people who don't go see those shows and support those bands who are still doing it. You want to save rock and roll? Go buy a ticket.
Right. And go out and buy the records by the people you like. Don't go and download the stuff.
Right. Right.
You know, do I care that Chris Bell has been gone for 40 years? No. I love his music. I will support his music. It's that simple.
Right.
This isn't rocket science.
Yeah, no.
It's rock and roll, and there's a world of difference.
Well, and not to – I don't want to make myself the center of this. I don't want to pat myself on the back. But just to prove that I literally put my money where my mouth is, this Thursday I'm laying down $40 for my wife and I to go see Peter Case, ex of the Plimsolls and the Nerves and a bunch of other really talented acts. And, you know, he's a really great singer-songwriter, a guy that I like a lot. And I'm going to see if, you know, we're trying to get him to come in on the show the day of his show so that he can promote and sell a few more tickets. And he's playing a fairly small venue to begin with. So with all of that said, could I easily have, you know, called his promoter and said, hey, why don't you slide us a pair of tickets or put us on the guest list? Sure, I could have done that. And chances are about 99% they would have done it for me. But you know what? I support rock and roll and I support musicians. I paid my $40. I'm going to the concert.
Well, you know what? I'll pat you on the back and then I'll pat myself on the back. Because, you know, we did the same thing when it came time for Big Star Third to be performed down in Washington, D.C.
Right.
I could have easily made a few phone calls and gotten onto the guest list at the 9:30 Club. But I didn't. I bought the tickets. I drove us down there, you know, because we wanted to see this. It's for the love of what you're seeing / hearing.
Yep, exactly.
That's all there is to it. And I don't – but the thing is, people get so high and mighty, and like everything else, they make it precious and about them, and they forget that it's a universal thing. It's like going to a sporting event. Okay, if you're so against the prices, don't go. Watch the ball game at home.
Right. Right, exactly. And the people who say, oh, this festival or that festival is killing the genre, what they're really saying is, I want rock and roll to happen for me. I want everybody else to do it for me. I don't want to contribute or participate in any way. Just bring me what I want. You know what? Because screw yourself.
I want it to be my flag of convenience.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it's just such a hateful attitude. Go out and do something. Yeah.
Something else we need to talk about, because you touched on it earlier, hockey. The Las Vegas Golden Knights.
Yes.
First season swept the Los Angeles Kings. They pounded them into the ground.
Yeah. And again, these are guys who were not cast-offs the way that the expansion drafts used to happen. But still, yeah. These are not top-level talent. These were not guys who were $5 million a year players before this.
Except for maybe James Neal and Marc-Andre Fleury.
Right. Still...
The two Stanley Cup finalists, you know, the captain of one team and the goaltender who got the Stanley Cup. With the other.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, there were people during the Cup Finals who were grousing, and in fact, even before that, during the playoffs, who were grousing about Marc-Andre Fleury. And so, you know, it wasn't, he was seen by some of the fans, I won't say all of them, but by some of the fans in Pittsburgh as being well past his prime and worth dealing. So, yeah, I mean, he was making the money, but he was not seen by his home team as the star they couldn't let go.
It's a pity that the Rangers can't do that with Henrik Lundqvist, but that's completely
right. But yeah, but I love it. I would. How would you like to see Las Vegas and
Nashville?
Yeah,
I want to see Las Vegas and Nashville in the finals, and I wouldn't care who won.
Right.
Either one is fine with me. I'd like to see Nashville win it because they were there last year, and I think they deserved it. I mean, hell, it went to a game seven.
Right.
But I would like to see Nashville win it. Listen, if Las Vegas were to make the Stanley Cup Finals in their maiden season, that's a story right there. That's history right there. But so far it's been an uneven kind of bunch of games because the Devils were no match for the Lightning, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Columbus, I thought, had the upper hand on Washington, but they've let that slip away.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that. I would like to see them take out Washington tonight once and for all. Toronto and Boston, I don't care about one iota.
No, I just want to see Boston lose, but they're not going to.
And Colorado and Nashville, that just ended badly for Colorado. Great that they played a good game on Saturday when they miraculously came back very late in the third period to take two quick goals and win it 2-1. But I don't know. You know, look, the Rangers aren't in it, so my heart's not really in this, no matter what.
Same thing with me. Yeah. I mean, the Blues are well, they didn't even make the playoffs, and Buffalo's so far away.
And San Jose, I think they dispensed with – hell, who did they dispense with quickly? Because we haven't seen the round yet with San Jose and Winnipeg going at it.
Right.
Although Winnipeg, you know, they deserve some comeuppance for the nonsense they pulled against Minnesota.
Yes.
The cheap shots. So, and they haven't really been called on it.
But that's what makes it fun. So it's a long second season and we're just now getting into the meat of it. But yeah, Las Vegas, that's a team's going to be fun to watch over this thing, just to see how much they've got in the tank.
Two more quick things. One, we also should mention the passing of Vern Troyer, a.k.a. Mini-Me.
Yeah, right.
Who, tragically, I believe, took his own life.
Yeah, they and I don't think they've said for sure, but he did attempt suicide like a week ago. So the fact that he ended up dead a week later, if it wasn't by his own hand, that would come as quite a shock. But he's a guy who struggled with severe alcoholism for a very long time. And he's only 49 years old, so... sad either way.
And also, to get back to the sports thing for a moment, we've talked about how many games have been postponed due to the weather over the last couple of weeks. And last night they actually flashed a graphic. 26 games thus far in the month of April because of weather, predominantly snow.
Yeah, and that has never happened in April before. That's more games than have ever been postponed in any month of April in Major League Baseball history.
And before we get to in our heads, finally, there was one last bid attempt to keep alive or at least resuscitate Toys R Us by a billionaire, and the holders of Toys R Us voted against it. They voted to liquidate. So it was never about saving the jobs.
No.
So to them, they can all go straight to hell.
Yeah, right. And in the meantime, if you could still find one that's open, you can probably find some pretty good deals on whatever they have left. So, yeah, we'll keep an ear on it as time goes on. But as we get to the In Our Head segment, as I said, I want to go back to one of the albums that you reviewed, in Nina June, because, as I said, she reminded me a lot in her delivery and just the vocal tonal qualities of the early stuff from Amy Mann. And I've always loved Amy Mann, whether it was with Till Tuesday or the solo stuff that she released after that. She has a voice that hits my ear very well. Rare. I'm going to sound like a sexist pig right now, and I don't care. I don't like most female vocalists, and it's not their fault. It took me a long time to realize this, but during the era in which I grew up, both in the 70s and the 80s, there were two things that female vocalists did as a signature. One of them was the "I'm so sexy I can barely talk above a whisper," and the other one was the Whitney Houston "I'm going to blow you away with my voice." And neither one of those appeals to me. But they weren't doing it on their own. They were doing it because producers and record industry people were telling them this is what sells. So things like that's why Carole King's album stood out, is that she didn't do either one of those things. She just sang her songs, man, you know, and it worked brilliantly. So it was always much more of, you know, when the girl groups started up, when we started to see the Go-Go's and, yeah, right, exactly. And, you know, a couple of these really talented bands come along. You listen to the style that they were singing, and it was the same way the guys were singing, but suited, you know, in key to their own vocals. So I don't know if it, you know, if it's the same way with you, if you can't, if the sort of overwhelming, overproduced nastiness that was afflicting a lot of female vocalists hit you as harshly as it did me. But who are the ones that stood out to you as being the best ones to listen to? Because we spend so much time talking about a lot of music that was made by guys. So who are the women that you really dig?
Well, the first one was Linda Ronstadt.
Yes.
Because, you know, as a kid, I had such an incredible crush on her.
How could you not? I mean, same thing with Amy Mann.
Right. I was totally in love with Linda Ronstadt, but she had a great voice. She could rock, but she didn't over-rock.
Right.
You know? And, I mean, you listen to her on different drum, and that's with the Stone Ponies in 68.
Mm-hmm.
But then you listen to something like Blue Bayou, which is just plain touching.
Fishing boats with their sails afloat. If I could only see that familiar sunrise through sleepy eyes, how happy I'd be.
But then she gets ballsy on "You're No Good."
But see,
you
know? Back up a second, because on Blue Bayou, it's also not overwrought. It's touching, but it's not, "Oh, poor me."
Right. It's not wafy.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. At the same time, and you can't really qualify her as a rock singer, even though she came up during the rock era of the early 70s, you couldn't help but turn your head when you heard Bette Midler sing.
Yeah.
Because that woman, forget it, I just love Bette Midler. And I'm not even gay, but I just love Bette Midler. I am, however, and
yes,
so
right.
Is she. So
yep.
She's just right for me. You know, she did a song that I absolutely despise, But she made the song work. That awful Delta Dawn.
Oh, which was yeah.
Tanya Tucker and by Helen Reddy, who I could not stand Helen Reddy. But Bette Midler's version just absolutely, that song puts in, her delivery of that song gives it an emotional texture that nobody else could get. Pure and simple. So that's early on. Now, Deborah Harry didn't have a great voice.
Nope.
But her voice worked in the context of those songs, especially the earlier songs like Ex-Offender and In the Sun or Rifle Range, or certainly the first time you felt, apart from the absolute love and desire that you had for Deborah Harry, because if you didn't, you're fucking retarded.
She did define sexy quite well.
I have never gotten over Deborah Harry. 43 years later, and I still haven't gotten over her. I will never get over her. She is the great love of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Period. But the first time, you know, like I said, Sex Offender or Ex Offender, I mean, it's really called Sex Offender, but I mean, Ex Offender and In the Sun, those were great, like, kind of bubblegummy punk songs. But then I'm Always Touched by Your Presence, Dear. That just hits you right in the heart. It's a beautiful piece, and her voice works in it, and it's not overproduced. It's when you get to the later stuff, it's like, okay, now they're trying to wring the character of Blondie out of Debbie Harry.
Right.
And as we all know, Blondie is a band.
Right. Right.
Period.
Well, and you know, there's an interesting sort of addendum to that is that what we haven't talked about, because I think both of us put them in a separate category altogether, are the hard rockers. Because when you talk about Heart, you know, Heart, Pat Benatar.
Ann Wilson's voice is amazing. And I liked some of their stuff, but I don't know. There was something about them overall. Like, I liked a couple of the singles. Even It Up's a great song.
Yep.
Baby Lestrange is a great song. But it was too watered down Zeppelin-y.
That's the thing, is that
they never hid their love of Zeppelin because they covered rock and roll.
Right.
But when you take a voice like Ann Wilson, I mean, that woman has got a gift as far as her vocal abilities. Now, to go for a different angle, the voice of Mavis Staples. That's a completely different realm. And Dionne Warwick.
Yeah.
Scepter singles of the 60s, the natural warmth and timbre of her voice and Walk On By.
Right.
Even though Isaac Hayes' version is fucking superior to anything that anybody ever did. And Do You Know the Way to San Jose? Complete charm and warmth. You know, those are great vocals.
Right. And so, yeah, that's the difference, you know, with the hard rockers, it's much easier for them to sound credible pushing it hard. And it's a little trickier, I think, when you get into pop music, where you have to depend on being a little more deft.
I'm sorry, I just have to say, you know, when it comes to the pop stuff, I basically disliked all of it, but it wasn't just the female singers. It's just that it all sounded alike.
Yeah.
I wasn't a fan of Pat Benatar, really, except for one album. I really liked the Get Nervous album, because Shadows of the Night is a great song.
Right.
That was a great song, but I've never been a fan of Pat Benatar's. I didn't like the whole leather thing. That was just kind of lame, you know? I'm a sex kitten pose.
Right. It's contrived.
Look at Chrissy Hynde. Not a conventional beauty, but Jesus Christ, was she sexy.
And not a conventional voice either, but boy, I could listen to it all day.
Right, because she knew how to deliver. She was a tough chick. I mean, you know, I shot my mouth off, bro, and you showed me what that hull was for. Gold right there.
Yeah, and
with tattooed love boys. Forget it. But the Pretenders were a magnificent band on that first album. But what happened? The second album, she puts up two songs that absolutely spin you around in a good way. Message of Love and Talk of the Town.
Right. And
suddenly it's not I'm Too Precious, Baby, Fuck Off.
Yeah, right. And you know, going back into the pure pop realm, mid-80s again, and another voice that I could listen to all day is Patti Smyth. And she didn't – she a couple of times edged toward the harder rock end of things, but for the most part was like – I mean, especially with the Scandal stuff, was right there in the middle of pop. And she's got a great voice.
It was that kind of, you know, dance the pony kind of pop, whereas – when the Go-Go's came along, you know what? I completely confess, I would only date a girl that was a Go-Go's wannabe. You know, yeah. that was. I mean, I was in love with all of them, but especially Kathy Valentine. Oh, God. I mean, she looked so much like Shirley MacLaine, and oh, God, she was so beautiful, and she still is one of the most gorgeous women I've ever laid eyes on. Yeah. She looks magnificent. She's a wonderful person. I love her. But the Go-Go's were a poppy band. They were neat little pop songs, catchy as all get out, and they live with you. That's great. When the Bangles came along, I really fell hard for them, not because of their looks,
which
were four of the most beautiful women on the planet, but the music just was, because it was my kind of music.
Yep.
That's the whole point. You know, them being part of the Paisley Underground, you listen to that first EP on Faulty. The Real, if they never recorded another song after The Real World, they didn't have to. That's a perfect song.
Yeah.
They did a masterpiece as their first track. And I believe I love you real. And it's the only thing I'm counting on. You never bring me down. Make me sad, it's such a change of me. Mary Street is an amazing piece of work. I'm In Line, which basically has Taxman written all over it.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the four of them could sing, and they sang harmonies in a way that only the Mamas and the Papas knew how to do. You know what I mean?
Right.
They had that certain something, and it could be because, you know, of Debbie and Vicki Peterson being sisters and them having such a good, you know, close friendship with Susanna Hoffs. But Annette Zelinskis, who was the original bass player, she was perfect in that original foursome. You know, Hero Takes a Fall was a great song. They did a great job with their cover of Going Down to Liverpool, the Katrina and the Waves song, which was written by Kimberly Rue. But I'm sorry, even though I'm sure you're going to be shocked when I say this, but you know what? I could have lived without them doing September Girls, but I'm grateful for them doing it because it gave Alex Chilton money and it put Big Star's name on the map. And I still want to know why the Bangles were never part of the documentary.
Yeah.
Why they were included in Nothing Can Hurt Me, because were it not for them, on an international level, Alex Chilton's name would not have been heard, save for people covering the letter. But not to digress, the Bangles were a band. You know, they were an organic band, you know, and I just loved that about them. And I could overlook the fact that they were four beautiful women. They made great music. I wouldn't have cared if they went around with, you know, bags on their heads and a Pillsbury XXX flower sack as their clothing. I didn't need to see them. All you had to do was hear them.
Right.
Now, the rest of that stuff was garbage. Madonna, as catchy as some of those songs are, sounded like crap,
yeah.
Processed crap. End of story. Whitney Houston, I never liked. I hate, despise, loathe, disdain of histrionics.
Yeah, I hate that. Right. Yeah, just sing. You don't have to blow me away. Just sing. And you know, another one that we haven't touched on that tried to mold themselves much more in line with the Bangles and the Go-Go's and the rest of them, I find Bananarama unlistenable. I can't stand them.
You know what? With them, I liked them because they were adorable, especially Karen Woodward. She yeah. was definitely my girl. But you're right. I mean, with the exception of maybe two or three songs that I couldn't tell. First of all, the first record sounded just like the Fun Boy 3 first album because they worked together.
Yeah.
So I don't need to hear any more of this stuff because it wasn't fun. No pun intended.
Right.
I looked at the Fun Boy 3 and I said, ugh, okay, you left the specials for this. Bananarama, the thing about the first Bananarama album, Deep Sea Skiving, was that it had two good songs. It had a great song called Cheers Then, which is a very touching song. It's a very sad song. And a song that was actually written for them by Paul Weller, called Dr. Love.
Oh, okay.
And that's the only time they kind of sound lively, too.
Yeah, and you're right.
It's not that lumbering, you know, Simmons and synth drum compressor thing. You know, all the electronic shit.
Right.
I completely went off Bananarama when they put out Cruel Summer, let alone Robert De Niro's Waiting. Ugh.
Yeah.
These are just terrible songs. And, you know, everybody has their moment, but there were also, you know, in New York, there was this great band, and this is the part that kind of always bothered me. This great band that was part of the Paisley Underground movement, even in New York, called the Trifles, and they had two fantastic musicians who happened to be girls. You know, they had this great guitar player and this great drummer. Unfortunately, they got overshadowed by their lead singer, who, you know, he kind of had that McGuinnish vibe about him. He had the hair and the glasses on and the Rickenbacker and all that sort of stuff. But it's kind of hard because you don't want and I'm not making any apologies, nor did I think for one moment you sounded like a, quote, sexist pig for saying it. We come from the rock background. It's a boys club. Not exclusively,
yeah, right.
It's a boys club. And that's all there is to it. You know, if I want my women to rock as hard as me, you know, well, then I'll go listen to Girls' School.
Right. And one that you may have missed, by the way. We're going to have to wrap it up on this, but are you familiar with Fanny?
Yeah, I know of them very well. Joan Jett was pretty, pretty. And she is a lovely, wonderful human being, but I've never been a fan.
No.
I love her songs.
No,
couldn't stand Runaways. They're awful. They're unlistable to me.
Yeah, exactly. Same deal here. But the band that kind of set the stage for them was this band Fanny, and I was unaware of them until just recently. And again,
they reunited.
They reunited. They put together another album, and I've got yet again back to the radio show. Another interview coming up with one of the members of Fanny, and it's a pretty damn interesting story. So I'm looking forward to this.
Well, there you go. I mean, look, people hate the Spice Girls, and I love them.
Well, tell me what you want, what you really, really want.
Right. That's all I want. That's what I really, really want.
There you go. Well, Rob Ross, great answers once again, and we will get back in our heads and have plenty more broadcasts for you next time around. Appreciate it, my man. Have a good week, and let's hope this one's a little quieter than the last one was.
I was about to say, with our fingers crossed and a hope and a prayer that, yeah, let's just not lose our shit anymore, people, at least for a week. Let's keep it tempered. Let's keep our eye on things. Baseball's in full swing. The Mets are still, God help us, in first place. I'm getting back to the gym. And let's just keep an eye on Donald Trump as being the main punching bag and have done with the rest.
Sounds good to me. I'll see you then.
Each other. Yes, indeed, sir. Have a great week. Stay well. And if the floodwaters don't rise, we'll be here.